Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present economist Max Wolf, who examines the collapse of major financial institutions, the damaged U.S. economy, and the links to deregulation policy advocated by conservative economists and politicians. Anita Weiss, professor of international studies at the University of Oregon, who assesses the negative consequences of unauthorized U.S. military raids inside Pakistan. And Carrie St. Pay, of the Barataria Terrebonne National Estuary Program near New Orleans, who discusses the natural protection from hurricanes that is lost with the destruction of coastal wetlands. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On Tuesday, September 16th, Bolivian troops arrested Leopoldo Fernandez, the rightist governor of Pando Northern Province, an opponent of Bolivia's leftist president, Evo Morales. Fernandez has been taken to the capital of La Paz and is being charged with genocide for allegedly ordering the deaths of at least 15 peasants who were machine-gunned during the past 2 weeks of unrest in Bolivia. Dozens of others have been wounded in the violence. The unrest was triggered by Morales' plan to conduct a nationwide referendum in January 2009 to approve a new constitution, which would give the indigenous population of Bolivia more power, allow Morales to run for a consecutive second term, and give land to landless peasants. Although Morales won 67% support in a recall referendum vote last month, conservative leaders of four out of Bolivia's nine states are demanding greater autonomy and a larger share of revenue from gas sales. The majority of energy fields are located in opposition strongholds. Evo Morales and Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez have accused Washington of provoking the violence. In protest, Bolivia and Venezuela have both expelled their U.S. ambassadors. The U.S. responded by expelling Bolivian and Venezuelan ambassadors and evacuating Peace Corps volunteers from Bolivia. The Union of South American Nations, or UNASUR, held a summit meeting in Chile to address the crisis in Bolivia and issued a statement of support for Morales. The high price of oil has changed the financial calculation of outsourcing production to China and other developing countries. Higher energy and shipping costs and a stronger American dollar convinced Excel Outdoors, a sporting goods manufacturer, to halt production of sleeping bags in China and open a factory in Haleyville, Alabama. According to the Washington Post, surging shipping costs now eat up half of the $10 retail price of an Excel sleeping bag at Walmart. Rising energy costs have forced manufacturers to rethink the value of production hubs across East Asia, putting pressure on small factories in China and Vietnam. At the same time, some companies have reopened plants in the United States and in northern Mexico. Thomasville Furniture made headlines over the summer when the company announced it was returning its entire production line to the United States. Although thousands of factory shops have closed in China in recent months, China remains one of the fastest-growing economies in the world. It retains a competitive edge against the United States and Europe with low material costs and a low-wage, non-union labor force. Supermax prisons seen on TV are represented as the most advanced in management of dangerous inmates. In these secured housing units, inmates are locked in a solitary cell 23 hours a day, monitored by cameras, and fed through a tiny slot in the prison door. Since the Supermax was developed in the early 1980s, harsh conditions at the high-tech prisons have come to light. They have a heavy concentration of mentally ill inmates and experience a high rate of suicide. Bonnie Kerness of the American Friends Service Committee told Alternet that conditions in the Supermax prisons amount to torture. 10% of all inmates in local, state, and federal prisons are now in solitary confinement. In addition, 40% of all prison suicides occur in isolation. Starting in the mid-1990s, citizen groups began organizing against Supermax complexes. Prisoner advocates have won some significant legal victories in recent months. New York State has banned solitary confinement for inmates with psychological disabilities. In Mississippi, the ACLU forced the reform of the Mississippi State Penitentiary, which once held over 1,000 inmates in solitary confinement. In an agreement with the Civil Liberties Group, the state has reduced the number in isolation by 90%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. We'll be right back.
Fear gripped U.S. and world markets as American investment bank Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy protection, Merrill Lynch was taken over by Bank of America, and mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac came under the control of the U.S. government. An estimated $700 billion was lost to those investing in retirement plans, government pension funds, and other investment portfolios. Wall Street saw a loss of value of more than 4% on September 15th, following Lehman Brothers' collapse, the biggest crash since the September 11th attacks. Stock markets in London and Tokyo fell to their lowest levels in more than 3 years. Much of the instability can be tied to bad loans made in the subprime mortgage market. Financial analysts looking for the next domino to fall were closely watching American International Group, or AIG, after the world's largest insurer's stock fell by some 60% and losses of almost $20 billion. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with economist Max Wolf, who examines the collapse of major financial institutions, the damaged U.S. economy, and the links to deregulation policy advocated by conservative economists and politicians.
It seems to be raining banks and bankers, and when it rains, it pours, apparently, in this business. So in the last 3 months, we've seen three of the five U.S. investment banks cease to exist either at all or as independent, starting in mid-March with the demise of Bear Stearns. It has been a season of trouble on Wall Street, and I think this pain both started outside of the financial markets and has already spilled well outside the financial markets, whether that's the massive 50% approximate sell-off in Chinese shares, or the seizure in the Russian markets that shut down their market, or the rising unemployment, or the rising misery of the general public here as wage growth stagnates and employment growth stagnates.
Max Wolf, how much of what we're seeing unfold on Wall Street is tied directly with deregulation policy that have been pushed by successive presidents, conservative economists, and politicians?
Part of what's changed in our deregulation is that we've deregulated both who can lend money, so it's not just the banks, what the banks can do inside each country in terms of lending money, and what banks and other firms can do in terms of international transactions. And part of what that's produced is a shift from what we used to call the originate-to-own model of lending to the originate-to-distribute model of lending. Under the originate-to-own model of lending, banks generally would make loans, and then they would enter a long-term partnership in which their prospects, their futures, and the futures of those people to whom they lent were wed, and so they would be cautious and careful, and sometimes also racist and discriminatory, but cautious and careful with who they lent money to and how much they lent and under what terms. In the age of international capital flows and deregulation, money from all over the world can zoop across international borders multiple times in a deal, and more banks and increasingly what they call non-bank financial intermediaries, which means not a regulated bank entity but someone who lends money, began the originate-to-distribute way of operating as financial firms, in which they made loans for the express purpose of selling them to someone else as fast as possible. Wall Street got in on that by securitizing these loans, which is a sort of fancy phrase for chopping them up and reformulating them into a mystery meat of different debts and then selling them around the world. And that's part of how this bubble got so big, a huge part of it, and why this bubble is so painful and so international as it busts and the shockwaves ripple out from ground zero, which is more or less the American subprime borrower. But increasingly, it affects college loans, credit card loans, auto loans, and prime home mortgage loans, as well as subprime home mortgage loans, where the trouble began.
Max Wolf, when you hear John McCain say that the fundamentals of the U.S. economy are quite strong, and you hear comments by Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama on what he would do if he were president to address these financial issues, what's your assessment of these two candidates and their prescriptions?
It looks like John McCain is doing something that sadly many in the mainstream press and an awful lot of citizens, our fellow citizens, have been doing, which is to kind of hope that this goes away by sheer force of will and pretending it's not here. And when McCain says the fundamentals are strong and he doesn't see much, you kind of wonder who he's kidding and what he thinks he's going to get out of saying that. So that is very much not hope-inspiring. When I hear it, I find it kind of shocking, and it seems a very poor electoral strategy and very strange. On the other hand, when I listen to Barack Obama talk about it, it reminds me of the worst of student oral presentations in my classes, in which you have a perfectly bright student who's clearly skimmed instead of read the material and is straining to remember the 10% of it he knew 10 minutes ago. So it does not sound like someone who's particularly knowledgeable, interested, or involved in these issues, and that's also upsetting because I expect some greater insight and possibly forward-looking solution from Senator Obama, and also because this is huge, it's here, it's now, and I have virtually no doubt that by November, when the elections roll around, the economic turmoil, the number of people in pain, the number of people in foreclosure, well above a million, is going to be the single biggest issue, and one would like to see the candidates deal with it in a much more reasonable and informed manner than either has so far.
If you were to advise these presidential candidates on how to address the current financial crisis, what are some of the top recommendations you'd make?
I would recommend that you cancel the interest payments and do small incremental reductions in the principals on the loans in an effort to safeguard the wealth, knowing full well that many people cannot and will not pay back all the interest and all the principal, and you can put the interest back on the tail end of the loan, you know, 20 years out or something, they can make their interest payments, because the people also have to feel like all their sweat and all their toil and all their tears, all they do to earn that money and stay in that house gets them some equity, because otherwise they're working really hard for a house that's declining in value to make payments, much of which are interest payments, for a house their prospects of owning outright in the foreseeable future are very dim. So I don't much think that was a particularly good idea. And I don't much like the pattern of private, untransparent dealings in which some firms are killed and other firms are rescued. And as to the Lehman deal particularly, Lehman should have been saved. Too little was done, and everybody was too smug with the idea that, oh, we don't do bailouts. But, I mean, who are you kidding? You've done 10 this year. Why not this one? Once you start in this business, you know, picking and choosing behind closed doors who lives and who dies on Sunday afternoons with the Treasury and the Federal Reserve and then announcing it as letting the market work its magic is kind of through the looking glass stuff, in my opinion.
That was economist Max Wolf. Read his commentaries online at HuffingtonPost.com and GlobalMacroscope.com. The increasing number and growing sophistication of Taliban attacks against the U.S.-led coalition forces in Afghanistan has some observers concluding that the conditions there are the most unstable they've been since the U.S. invasion in 2001. U.S. airstrikes and raids against suspected militants in towns and villages have caused an increasing number of civilian deaths and angry protests against the U.S., NATO, and the American-backed government of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Seeking to neutralize Taliban sanctuaries in neighboring Pakistan, the U.S. has in recent weeks launched a number of raids and missile attacks against Taliban and Al-Qaeda targets inside the country. According to press reports, President Bush in July secretly approved U.S. military attacks inside Pakistan without prior authorization from Pakistan's government. Pakistani officials say a September 3rd American raid against the border village of Angur Adda resulted in as many as 20 civilian deaths. On September 15th, Pakistani security forces fired at two U.S. Chinook helicopters and prevented their attempt to land on the Pakistani side of the border, according to local security officials and tribesmen. Pakistan's army said that its forces have orders to open fire if U.S. troops launch another raid across the Afghan border. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anita Weiss, professor of international studies at the University of Oregon, who assesses the negative consequences of unauthorized U.S. military raids inside Pakistan.
Well, my reaction is quite horrified by it, frankly, because when you think about it, the United States is actually engaging in military activity inside of an allied country. Pakistan has expended a lot to try to support the United States in the so-called war against terrorism. You know, after all is said and done, now without consulting with the government of Pakistan and without getting any type of, you know, green light whatsoever, the United States has unilaterally started to actually attack this allied country. If one of the goals of the U.S. government is to try to destabilize this recently democratically elected government. I mean, finally, after so many years, after 9 years of military government, you know, in February of this year, an elected participatory democracy came into power. And if one of the U.S.'s goals is to destabilize that government, then they're doing a good job. But if that's not part of the goals, then I think that a lot of people who are these, you know, so-called foreign policy advisors really need to be replaced, because this is going to be terrible for the future of Pakistan-U.S. relations.
There are reports that a September 3rd U.S. raid inside Pakistan killed an undetermined number of civilians there, and there were many protests among the population of Pakistan against this kind of U.S. military activity inside their nation. What are the short-term and long-term repercussions, you think, for Pakistan and the United States, given the U.S. Goal and mission of reducing violence in Afghanistan and really removing operational bases for the Taliban and al-Qaeda inside Pakistan?
Well, first off, I should clarify one thing. There have been at least 6 or 7 bombings inside of Waziristan in the month of September alone. The short-term implications of this are that for every time the U.S. engages in such practices, I think you're going to be alienating a couple of dozen more Pakistanis. A couple of dozen more people are going to be saying, why are we supporting the United States? Long-term implications, I think that Pakistanis, and especially Pakhtuns in these areas, are not going to forget quickly what happened, and I think that this is very deleterious for their U.S. reputation abroad.
What do you think the motivation here is? Is President Bush trying to gain some more credibility in terms of his legacy as president here by dislodging the Taliban or al-Qaeda from these Pakistani tribal areas, or maybe with the hope of capturing or killing Osama bin Laden before he leaves office? Do you have any ideas why the Bush administration is doing this now as opposed to maybe several years ago?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think that a lot of people are anticipating some type of an October surprise ahead of the U.S. presidential election, something that will help to get John McCain elected. We have to remember that September 11th, 2001 was already 7 years ago, and that, you know, the immediate action on the part of the U.S. right afterwards was to attack Afghanistan in October of 2001. Whether that was wise or ill-advised or whatever, the reality is that, you know, the news coverage made it seem like the Taliban, their Pakhtun followers, were hiding out in these remote caves without giving any mention to the fact that the United States had supervised the building of that whole cave complex in the early 1980s when the Mujahideen, who we were supporting, were fighting against, you know, the former Soviet Union. So I do think that this is an effort on the part of the Bush administration at least to try to show that they're still, you know, in the hunt for Osama bin Laden and his senior deputies. But, you know, by going off and wantonly killing civilians like this with no, you know, viable explanation as to why these areas in particular were selected, except to say that they were believed to house terrorist training camps. I'd like to see some actionable intelligence released to the American public saying, what proof did they have that there was some type of training camp going on?
Anita Weiss, there have been reports through the years that the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Agency, and other elements within the Pakistani government are allied with the Taliban and other Islamic militants. Is there a risk at some point if the United States continues to intervene there and cross the border without government authorization? Is there a risk that Islamic militants and their allies could take over Pakistan, a nuclear power, which is quite alarming, of course?
Certainly, U.S. actions like this, they end up in the long term serving to empower those same kind of militant extremist groups that the United States is ostensibly trying to fight against. Actually, I don't think they could find themselves in the seat of power, but I do believe that they could help to agitate to result in a civil war in Pakistan. for quite some time, there's been a real line between the eastern part of Pakistan and the western part of Pakistan. You know, the eastern part, Punjab, Karachi and Sindh there, Islamabad, these are much more liberal in orientation, western-oriented, part of the global economy, whereas you have many parts of the Northwest Frontier Province, Baluchistan, and certainly Fatah, the federally administered tribal areas, which are just really not part of the global economy or polity or anything. And there's some very distinct tensions that exist between the eastern and western parts of Pakistan. So I don't think that Pakistan in the foreseeable future can be overcome by militant Islamist groups, but I do think that they can agitate enough to create conditions of a good possibility of civil war in Pakistan.
That was Anita Weiss, professor of international studies at the University of Oregon and co-editor of the book Power and Civil Society in Pakistan. Read more about the current event in Pakistan in the online edition of the English Language Daily Dawn at dawn.com. On August 29th, the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina hitting New Orleans and the Gulf, Hurricane Gustav again threatened the city and the South Louisiana coast. 2 million people evacuated from the area, and the big news was that Gustav did not hit New Orleans. Lost in all the coverage of New Orleans dodging a bullet was any news of where Gustav made landfall. The hurricane had lost a lot of its punch by the time it landed in Cocodrie, about 70 miles southwest of New Orleans, but still downed thousands of trees and knocked out power to most of the state. Wetlands and offshore islands have served for centuries as barriers when hurricanes sweep in from the Gulf of Mexico. But now that so many islands and so many hundreds of square miles of wetlands have been destroyed by oil and gas drilling operations, general development, and the effect of climate change, hurricanes now threaten coastal areas with greater devastation. The more recent destruction wrought by Hurricane Ike on the Texas coast can be attributed in part to improper stewardship of thousands of square miles of wetlands that used to provide natural flood protection. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Carrie St. Pei, the director of the Baratia Terrebonne National Estuary Program in Bayou Country, southwest of New Orleans. He says the heaviest damage from Gustav occurred around Bayou Lafourche and explains what must be done to restore the wetlands.
1,000 years ago, Bayou Lafourche was the Mississippi River. In 1905, it was dammed. And by 1955, it became a stagnant pool, and pumps were put in place to pump water from the Mississippi River into Bayou Lafourche. And we've been relying on those pumps ever since. The hurricane caused something I've never seen in my 34-year career. It caused Bayou Lafourche to go anaerobic. In other words, black, smelly water for 40 miles. And Bayou Lafourche is used as a water supply. So this is quite a story. 300,000 people are without a water source right now.
Do you know exactly why that happened?
Yeah, because of the direction of the storm, it forced water movement, sudden water movement, in the dance of the hurricane-forced winds to stir up the bottom organic matter. And once that was stirred up, the bacteria that decompose such things took over and used up all the oxygen in the water, causing it to go septic.
And what's the situation now? Is it still like that?
Yeah, it is. We have an emergency need to dredge Bayou Lafourche to upper 6.2 miles, and that's taking place beginning next week.
Is that something that's done periodically, or is this a first?
No, this is a first. Bayou Lafourche has become silted in, and it's reached critical levels. It's hampering our ability to get water to the water plants. We have Ike approaching, that's causing surge to come from the Gulf, keeping the water from moving to the south. And it's a big mess right now.
Carrie St. Pei, what impact, if any, do you think Hurricane Gustav had on the wetlands in southern Louisiana?
Well, I flew over it yesterday, and the Barry Islands really took the brunt of the storm. The water level was still very high, so I couldn't tell how much of the marsh was affected. But the only way we're going to rebuild our coast is by pumping sediments from the bottom of the Mississippi River and Chaffalaya River and from offshore sources. And we would sustain that with small to medium water diversions. We have to physically harvest the sediment from the bottom of rivers to rebuild the land.
Last year, a law passed in Congress that would fund projects, a multi-billion dollar law, to fund projects to begin to restore the wetlands, but no money has been appropriated yet. The new governor, Bobby Jindal, has just pledged $300 million from the state surplus, which comes, I guess, from oil and gas royalties, to rebuilding the wetlands. How does that amount of money compare to the need?
It's a drop in the bucket, but it's something. At this point, I'm reaching for anything I can get.
When I visited you in your office in Bayou Country last year, we were talking about the sad state of the wetlands and whether they can be rebuilt in order to once again serve as a storm buffer and a rich ecosystem, and really just to allow a unique way of life to survive. Would you say now that you're more or less hopeful about the future than you were a year ago?
That's hard to say. I'd say I'm more hopeful because of the governor we have. But I don't know where the money is going to come from.
That was Carrie St. Pei of the Baratia-Terrebonne National Estuary Program based in Thibodaux, Louisiana. Contact the group at 1-800-259-0869 or visit their website at btnep.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Elaine Osowski, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.